the Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. You see it, we help you do it. AIB, for the life you're after.
Our first guest this morning started his career running nightclubs in Brighton with Fatboy Slim. He's hosted London's Elite in his many restaurants, but it's his current project, Exit Here, helping people plan the perfect funeral that he says has given him the most satisfaction. Oliver Payton, you're very welcome to the programme. We'll get your thoughts on the restaurant industry and various other things shortly, but let's go back to the beginning. Growing up in Swinford, County Mayo, on the small family farm, do you have lots of happy memories of that?
Yeah, I do. I think it was, it was a sort of Huckleberry Finn existence, really, because, you know, you could roam around freely. And, the farm was on the moor. I used to go fishing. I was very lucky, very good memories.
Once I hear the word farm, I think work. Was there a lot of work to be done when you were younger? And how did you feel about that?
Oh, I vividly remember walking with my dad 4 in the morning, taking the cattle into Swinford to sell in the town square. So, with the dog, I remember.
And was it the kind of fairly traditional lifestyle where when it came to food and cooking, your mother would have done a lot of cooking, and would you have even, killed your own animals for the dinner?
Oh, my God, yeah. One of my greatest memories is my mother used to kill a goose at Christmas. And, the geese are not like chickens. Chickens are pretty easy to say goodbye to. Geese know what's coming. And they sort of put up some resistance. And, I really remember that. I mean, I also remember, killing a pig, and it was hung up in the barn. And, I used to stir the blood because, it used to congeal so quickly. I was always fascinated by how quickly it congealed.
That's the kind of stuff that stays with you, Oliver.
Sure does.
And what about school? Did you enjoy school? Did you hate it? How did you feel about it?
I went off to boarding school at an early age. I went to St. Mary's Dundalk for a year, and it was pretty tough. I was pretty miserable. So then I moved to Summerhill when it was boarding, and, I was much closer to home. I think boarding school, boys' boarding school, was very tough.
How did you find it academically?
Oh, well, academically, I was poor because, I was super dyslexic. The only way I found out I was dyslexic was when my son was diagnosed with dyslexia. And then I sort of, everything fell into place for me.
How did it manifest itself? I mean, it can show itself in different ways with different people where they've particular problems with things.
Well, I couldn't read out loud. The words would juggle up. They still do. If I have to read out loud, it's still a real problem for me. But if I'm reading to myself, it doesn't really matter because I can juggle up the words, but I still get the gist, if you know what I mean. It was a real problem, and I just thought I was stupid. I was never going to be a doctor or a vet or anything like that or an accountant because, it was just not, because I just thought I was a bit stupid. So I always sort of knew I was going to have to work for myself. In some ways, that's why it's a mixed blessing, because I'm grateful in a way that I had to struggle. It's not something I would recommend, by the way. But
but it is extraordinary, the number of people, really successful business people I talk to on this show, who have had dyslexia in school and can point to not only the difficulties, but how it kind of influenced things in a way.
Well, you're sort of an outsider, aren't you? You're not like everybody else.
Were you rebellious, Oliver, as a teenager?
I was a mixed bag, I would say. My mother would describe me as a very good boy. I love punk music. And
They all say that, Oliver. Even if you went out and shot somebody, the mother would still say you were a very good boy.
I think I was all right, but I was, I loved music and, I was into punk and so I always enjoyed that.
It must have been quite a culture clash with the musical tastes of your parents and their generation. How did they respond to the young punk Oliver coming home from school?
My parents were actually quite liberal, but my mother let me go to New York on my own when I was 14. So I wouldn't describe her as someone who was very conservative. But at the same time, I had a Vivian Westwood prick up your ears T-shirt, which had a picture of two naked cowboys, which I think crossed the threshold for her. And she burned it. You know, I was
she
like,
burned
I'm,
it.
I'm, yeah, I went, where's my T-shirt, Mom? She went, that filth.
she said, I'm a liberal, but I can only take it so far.
Yeah, and that was my most prized possession as well. So, you know, it was, but you know, she was great.
So you went on to college, you studied in Leicester, and it was kind of really around that time that you pursued that interest in music and you ended up organising events and running clubs. You met Fatboy Slim, you started to sort of hang around with a lot of different interesting people around the music scene.
Yeah, you know, I didn't have any money, and nightclubs presented a way of making money because you didn't really need much money to do them, if you know what I mean. You would just go and, I mean, my first club in Brighton, you know, it was a basement under a very seedy gay bar, which sort of, the landlord was super happy to see someone coming along who wanted to rent it because, you know, it hadn't been used in a very long time. So it was hardly a tough sell.
And did you make good money out of it?
Yeah, we made good money because it was like, you know, we were running warehouse parties as well. It was all cash. And, you know, I was building up a little pile of money. You couldn't borrow money from a bank. I mean, this is back in the day when, you know, one had to go to the bank in your suit and you had to beg them. I mean, you know, this is not that long ago. I mean, I know I'm old, but I'm not that old.
But you obviously had a real flair for it because the Brighton Club went well. You set up Raw in London and you introduced all of these kind of novel marketing techniques. That was very much you. Did you find you were good at that?
Oh, yeah. Marketing's my thing. And I think also at the time in London, it was a pretty big club in central London, so you had to be pretty aggressive. You know, we could be doing 1,200 people a night through the door. And, you know, a lot of the other clubs, my competitors, were much smaller than that. And some of them were smaller, you know. But, you know, you had to be creative to fill it, if you know what I mean.
You would have met a lot of very well-known people, a lot of people around the music scene at that time. You roped George Michael into doing doorman one time.
He took the money one night in the club. Yeah, so people would come down the stairs because it was four floors down. And so there'd always be a long queue coming down the stairs. And it was a back stairs as well. It was like a fire escape for a car park. So it was pretty seedy. And people used to queue coming down the stairs. And, you know, we would just have a till at the bottom just by the entrance. And, yeah, George Michael done the door one night. It was very funny.
Nightclubs can be a great way of making money when they go well, but also it can be a lot of hassle. It's late hours, but there's also that sense of anything can happen. It's not necessarily easy.
Anything
money,
did
is
happen.
It?
Anything did happen. Trust me on that.
Like what? Were there any particularly hairy nights?
Oh, I remember one night. I was leaving. Normally, you wouldn't get out of a club till about 6 or 7 in the morning. And I remember one morning I was coming out and I had all the money with me. And I was set upon by some people. And I was actually on Tottenham Court Road and they were beating the daylights out of me. They were only beating the daylights out. They didn't know that I had, I'm not going to tell you how much money it was, but it was a lot of money. And I'm actually physically on Tottenham Court Road. And there was no one on the road because it's the time of the morning. And all I can see is I'm lying on Tottenham Court Road and they're beating the living daylights at me. And I can just see all of the money floating down Tottenham Court Road. It was like, it was terrible. Yeah.
What about gangs? Did you, in that nightclub scene, you must have come across and had clientele by choice or otherwise who were in gangs or drug gangs.
You know what the funny thing about London is? There's a certain myth around gangs. And of course, you come across lots of different characters and everything else. But gangs stick to themselves. If they have a venue, they control the venue. And they do whatever they're doing there because, you know, lots of gangs would be laundering money through venues they owned. I always had a good relationship with some of those characters because they didn't impede on my turf. And, you know, we just done what we'd done. We knew who, you know, I mean, the key with running a business in that type of business is to run a straight game. You cannot be allowing you know, dealers to deal, and you can't be allowing people to, you know, encroach on your standard operating manner, if you know what I mean.
You had a restaurant in Manchester after you'd moved into the restaurants business in London, and you'd a bit of a tough, you'd a tough time there.
Then I discovered gangs.
In Manchester, that's when you came face to face, was it?
Oh, God, yeah.
Why, what happened?
I had to hire a film crew to pretend to be doing a BBC Panorama documentary about gangs to try and stop them trying to take over the control of the door, control of the narcotics supply in my venue.
That's pretty tough. There's nothing in a business management school can teach you for that. Teach you about that.
No, there isn't really. But, you know, I think the issue was, you know, it was a different time. The Hacienda just closed. And I think some people were looking for different retail opportunities.
Did that end badly, Oliver? Were you sort of glad to get out of it? I mean, did stuff go missing or?
Oh, yeah. I had a huge picture which was given to me by Sam Taylor Wood, which was 3 meters wide, which was stolen from a wall in the restaurant. And I was just, I think that was the final straw, because we had loads of CCTV everywhere and we still couldn't, you know, it was a nightmare, really. You know, I think
that wasn't going to fit under somebody's jacket.
No, I was very lucky because I owned the building. So, you know, I think one of the things about restaurants is the time you make the most money is when you sell them.
And it's hard going otherwise. But during that period and in the 1990s, the music scene in Britain was huge. There was all of the Tony Blair, Cool Britannia in the latter part of the 90s. Mm. You would have got to know a lot of people. You would have got to know the Gallagher brothers from Oasis, Liam and Noel, who obviously have been in the news with the reunion. You were even referred to as the third Gallagher by A.A. Gill. Did you take that as a compliment?
I don't remember that. Adrian's a very nice man, though, I would say, and a very interesting a guy. He was a lovely man. I don't remember that, but Noel is a very, very nice man.
How did you feel about them getting back together? Will you go to the concerts?
Will I go to concerts? Probably is the answer to that. And good luck to them is all I can say. I mean, I think what's interesting about music right now, I mean, if you look at Coldplay at the weekend and stuff like that, is, and you just look at the nature of going to concerts, they are no longer just standing around playing mostly. They are theatrical, they're experiences, you know, and I personally love that. I think it's great to go to a place, you know, and just where it's just a whole big vibe, if you know what I mean. It's sort of part theatre, part clubbing, part religion.
When it comes to the entertainment industry, where do you see it going in the future? Whether it's nightclubs, venues, big shows?
I think nightclubs are a little bit sad in a way, because I think the problem you have with nightclubs is the problem you have with restaurants, the problem you have with anything is the cost of opening the doors. You know, a lot of the areas that were physically available to run nightclubs, which were in sort of derelict neighborhoods, don't really exist anymore. And, you know, they've all been turned into, you know, sort of Stalinist type of apartment blocks. I just can't see the financial model working very much in cities around traditional nightclubs. You know, what I do see, you know, when you go to Vegas or you go to Ibiza, you just have these huge entertainment spaces and they're operating 24 hours a day. So the financial model is different. You know, if you're operating a nightclub in a, you know, suburban Dublin, which is only trading for 4 hours and, you know, you're not selling very much alcohol because everyone's off their chops. You know what I mean? It's not a great business model, is it?
One of the things about that model, though, staying open for much longer and constantly going, is it makes it a much more difficult industry for people to work in. The demands, the wages, it's really difficult. We're also seeing, for example, even in the restaurant business in Ireland, we're seeing a lot of restaurants close where their costs have gone up. Yes, they have people coming through the door, but it just doesn't financially stack up anymore.
No, my heart goes out to lots of these people because they've taken the risk. They've probably remortgaged their house. it's very tough to open a restaurant just in any period of time. It's not just now, but now I think it's a perfect storm. You got high rents, you got high service charges, you got ridiculous taxes, you got ingredient costs, which are just, I mean, the numbers just don't stack up. I mean, the other thing I find, you know, this is online booking thing. I mean, it has lost the humanity of dealing with customers, you know, and I think in this sort of time, your opportunity to deal with people on the phone and take care of them is sort of vital.
Do you think there's scope for something like that to come back? Because it's the kind of thing that both customers and people in the business say they miss, and it was better in those days. And yet, at the same time, you get that sense that a lot of people don't really want that. They're just used to convenience, and convenience means online, book it, and it's done.
I just don't see, maybe I'm old-fashioned, but I just don't see the hospitality business like that. The hospitality business is taking care of people. How do you take care of them? By speaking to them. You know, you got to nail the customer.
In entertainment and hospitality, you've done so many different things, from the nightclubs to restaurants. You even managed a band at one stage. But you also ratcheted things up into sort of commercial restaurants, where the business you were running had several hundred people. You had about 12 restaurants in different locations. All of that gets exhausting. And you kind of reached a point where you just got burned out with it.
I did get burned out with it. But, you know, I think this is part of this whole thing around fear of failure. And I think it's a very tough business. And I think when we talk about mental health now and things like that, I mean, now talking about mental health, I feel in a way we shouldn't need to talk about it. It's just part of stuff we do to take care of ourselves. And, you know, I definitely needed to, you know, take care of myself, because I did. I burned out. And, you know, I think it was, it was the best thing I'd done, because it reset myself and it made me think a lot more about how I wanted to live my life. Because I think this idea of just working all the time, I mean, it was just the way I was brought up. Be successful. I wanted to make my parents proud. And, you know, I didn't know how to stop, to be honest with you. I was just a machine. And I think, you know, learning and taking the time to learn how to have a balanced life is something everybody has to do. I mean, now, when I look at what I do now, it's sort of, you know, running a funeral business. I wish I'd started a funeral business 30 years ago, because you learn super quickly what's important in life when you're in the funeral business. It's like, it's probably the greatest therapy you will ever have. The amount of people I see coming through my door that are young and are, you know, that died prematurely makes you treasure every moment that you have.
How did you get into the funeral?
No. How did I get into it?
How did you get into it? Yeah.
When my parents passed, I was completely shocked by the lack of choice available. Now, my parents are soul to the earth, working class Irish people who wanted a traditional service. When you're in grief, my old man had a heart attack. When you're in grief, you get carried along by the funeral director. And that's what happened to us. And I mean, me and my sisters were standing over the grave, and we just turned to each other and went, yeah, he wouldn't have been happy about this. And it just sort of sparked something with me, because, you know, I'm sort of looking at it and thinking, hang on a second, this is a hospitality business. This is about taking care of people. There isn't just one type of restaurant. So why is there just one type of funeral director? You know, and you want people to stand there and go, that is the person that I loved. And you want to create, because you're creating memories for the people that are alive. The person who died is a bit player on the day, if you know what I mean, in terms of because you want to create memories for the people that are left behind. So that's what we try and do, you know. But also, it's just a fascinating business because it's about life.
What's the most unusual request you've had for a funeral?
I'll tell you the funniest one was, we had this gay man who was religious. He was Church of England. He was Church of England. And he wanted four topless bearers. And so, and he wanted a gay vicar. So we got the gay vicar, and we got the, our bearers anyway are pretty handsome, you know, young men. So they would, they didn't mind getting their kit off, so that was no problem. But the vicar wouldn't allow topless bearers because he said it was so hard being gay in the church still that they would use it as some sort of thing to beat him with. So we didn't end up having it in the end, but it was still a great service.
What about your own funeral someday, Oliver? Have you thought about that? What would you like?
You know, we do a lot of repatriation back to Ireland, by the way. So it always touches a nerve with me for some reason when people are going back to be buried. So there's a choice of two things for me. There's a little graveyard in Killary Harbour. There's a road and then some headstones on the seaside in Killary Harbour. I know I can't be buried there, but that would be the place I would love to be buried. But otherwise, under a tree.
Have you decided on the whole service, the music that'll be played? Have you thought about it in that detail?
Oh, it's super important. You should never, I mean, you know, the amount of people that come into us and go, oh, I don't know what, you know, John or Mary would have wanted. And we're going, you know, you should always leave instructions about what you want for your funeral for lots of reasons. One is because the most important reason is because people just kick into the long grass the idea of planning their funeral because they think it's not, you know, they look at funeral directors and think, oh, I hope I never have to go in there. But the fact that you plan your funeral gives you acceptance of the fact that you're going to die and it makes you live your life better on a day-to-day basis. It is fundamental to our existence, I think, to plan your funeral.
So have you written up the playlist and everything?
I've got my menu and everything. I know exactly what I want. So, you know, there's, I've got it all mapped out.
Anything interesting on the menu, Oliver?
I love white truffles. That's a very expensive funeral. So I would have white truffle risotto.
You've plenty of life insurance. Somebody would be paying for it.
I've got very expensive taste in food. Yeah, so it's quite an expensive menu.
You said there when you were talking about realization about stuff that there were things, you know, you wish you knew back then when you were younger that you know now that you wish you'd learned earlier. What do you think that would be?
I probably would have kept a lower profile, I would say, if I had the choice again.
You also mentioned about maybe one of the reasons why you had worked so hard and gone round the clock. It's part of the industry as well, but that you'd really put everything into it was maybe a kind of a sense of low self-esteem. And yet the confidence that you must have had as a young man going over to England from a small family farm in Mayo to do all of the things and to rub shoulders with all the people that you did and do what you did, you would imagine from the outside, this guy is super confident. He must have the highest self-esteem.
Well, I think that's a very interesting point, actually, because self-esteem, I mean, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that it's not that I had low self-esteem. I didn't have any self-esteem. I mean, I was dealing with presidents of the United States. You know, we were doing hospitality for royals. My self-esteem was, it really was a problem. I think I didn't have the tools available to me to deal with that. I think dyslexia was a little bit part of that. I think going to boarding school in a restrictive boys-only environment and never really dealing with the outside world, you know, because when you're in a full boarding school and in boys' boarding school, you're not really interacting with the world, are you? You're in this sort of hermetically sealed environment.
But where do you think the confidence came from?
I learned it.
Like a skill?
Well, I mean, first of all, I learned it because there's different layers to this. I mean, there's dyslexia confidence, where you have to learn how to deal with the world. And many dyslexics turn out to be really great at speaking and selling and talking and, you know, getting their way around things. You have to have different tools in your box to deal with life. I think dyslexia has given me a great life, you know what I mean? So it also helped me a great deal.
Did it feel really good to you to employ so many people when the business was at its height and you had all of these staff? Was that something that made you very proud, that was a good feeling?
Yeah, it's good. It was a great feeling. I had thousands of employees at one point, you know, because the business was huge. But, you know, I recoiled from that because I just didn't want to have a big business. And there's lots of opportunity. I mean, it's like with the funeral business. I am besieged by private equity. I'm besieged by people who wanted to franchise it in the US and in all over the world. You know, I could open 10 in Florida tomorrow if I wanted to. But I don't want to do that.
Why not?
I don't want to. I don't need to. I'm living my life the way I don't want the pressure. I don't want the stress. I don't want to go to Florida to work. Don't even want to go there on holiday. I don't really like Florida anymore. but you know, I don't want to be on a plane. You know, it's my choice.
Well, it's great to have reached that point in your life where you're very comfortably able to make those choices. Oliver Payton, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us on the program.
My pleasure. Nice to talk to you.